Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight on The Big Show, director Rod Laurie tells us all about his new film, Nothing But the Truth. Our home video correspondent, Arenado Diaz, stops by to tell us about the latest DVD releases. And fellow movie geek Chris joins us for a roundtable discussion on the Golden Globe nominations, coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome, everyone, to Movie Geeks United, a great Sunday night episode of our show tonight. My name is Jamie, and I'm joined by Jerry. Hey, Jerry.
What's up? Are you there?
I am here. I'm
okay.
Sorry. I came from my father's birthday party. I reached to the door about 2 minutes ago.
Okay. But, you had me scared.
We're up and running, so we're
okay,
doing well.
Okay, awesome.
And our correspondent, Arenado Diaz, is here with us, too. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Hey, what's up?
Thanks for your patience, guys.
No problem.
We got a packed show tonight, so we want to get us started with a DVD report, the latest releases that you guys can look forward to purchasing this holiday season out there. We have some reviews for you. We've checked them out. We've done some legwork for you guys. So let's get started. What are the titles on the roster tonight, Aaron?
Well, why don't we do... We'll start off with my exclusive title that only I saw because I'm the de facto Blu-ray correspondent.
That's right.
I got Lost, the complete fourth season on Blu-ray.
Ooh.
And this is pretty spectacular. And Jerry, you might be able to chime in here because I know Jamie's not the most loyal follower of Lost.
I've seen the first season, and that's all I've seen.
I've seen most of the fourth. I'm still playing catch up, so you got to film. You know, it's one of the best shows I think on network television, without a doubt.
It really is. I mean, for network television, it really is high quality. And the fourth season, which everyone was really anticipating because the season three finale was just spectacular, just a real game changer rebooting of the show. And it's just spectacular. So everyone was really hyped for season four, and season four really is good. I think the fact that J.J. Abrams, but also the showrunners, Carlton Cuse and Daniel Lindelof, basically decided, okay, we have an ending. We're not going to be able to string along the audience like some other shows. We're going to tell people that we have the ending, we know where we're going, and it really tightened up the narrative. So you didn't get some of these like in season two and particularly season one, where you got these kind of standalone episodes that were kind of neat in themselves with little character developments, but they didn't really add to the quote-unquote the mythology. So in season four, really, you got a real tightening of narrative and of characterization. Even when they brought in new characters, like they did in season four, you weren't worried because apparently everything had a purpose.
Right.
Season four was really spectacular. You got... And then they stopped the flashbacks, and now they were doing flash forwards.
Mm-hmm.
That's very risky. And the Blu-ray, obviously the regular standard definition DVD is, you know, chock full of extras, but the Blu-ray goes that extra mile, and the quality of the picture and sound. You know, Lost has always been one of the new millennium shows. It's always been one of the top quality
cinematic, yeah,
cinematic shows.
That's right.
Like 24, in a similar vein, you know, those, you know, DVDs have always been top flight, and the CSIs to a lesser extent. And so this one is just spectacular. And from what I've heard, I did read a report, I guess it was a week or two ago, that eventually all of the seasons of Lost will be coming out on Blu-ray.
Well, that's great.
Okay, so this is the only one currently that's out on Blu-ray this season?
That is correct. That is correct.
Okay.
So let me ask you something, Aaron.
Yeah.
Not about the disc so much, but about the show itself. It does seem with the season finale of the end of season three, it seems like the urgency has definitely come back to the show.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new sense of urgency, and I think that's what's really added to. I mean, that's why people can't wait till for January to get around, because it's just the urgency is back. I mean, what everything that made the first season so incredible, that's what's come back, and more so.
Yeah, and I think the fact that we realize they made a very wise decision, and I'm sure it was a tough one because it does cut into profit and so
mm-hmm.
forth of truncating the seasons. These are not full 22, 24 episode seasons. They're like, I think it was 16 or 17 last year, and then I think it's going to be 18 this year, 18
mm-hmm.
or 20. And so by doing that, it's forcing them to really hone in on their storytelling skills. And so it's just, and it has worked. I mean, it's, ever since Sopranos came on, and actually a little before that with like Oz and Larry Sanders on HBO.
Right.
Taking the model from England of the short season, the 13 episode or the
mm-hmm.
6 episode, some stories don't, they can't withhold 22,
yeah.
24 episodes.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
So by padding
much more than 5 seasons. What
yeah.
I'm, this is a question, though,
yeah.
because obviously if you're a Lost fan
mm-hmm.
the Blu-ray technology now, this would be a definite recommend.
Yes.
But is this show, usually shows with premises that rely upon what the heck is going on, don't sustain themselves. How has this one done that?
I think it sustained itself by coming up by knowing where the ending is, and by saying, we're not going to pad out each story, with the 24 episode seasons. We're going
right.
to do 18 to 20. By forcing us to do that and giving these last, I think there's only 2 more seasons left, 5 and 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And by giving those seasons an arc and knowing where we want to go with each one has really been able to maintain the fan interest. I was always a fan. I know season 2 went in for a lot of drubbing because it dragged out in kind of an almost an existential way, but I thought that was kind of fun, but I also saw that could be very trying on someone's patience.
You're right.
But,
you are right about that.
But it does work. And as far as this box, the Blu-ray is 5 discs. I think the standard definition is 8 discs. And the extras really go that extra mile into really giving the fans what they want going into.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a whole feature on the new cast members.
Mm-hmm.
The people they call the freighter. The people on the freighter.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really do delve into that stuff, and I think that's what people have wanted. And it's funny that a lot of freighter people, for some cross-pollination for other cult shows, a lot of people have made guest appearances like on Deadwood. And, they've been, previously on Deadwood, and now they're
right.
getting 2-3 episodes here on Lost. And so you're really getting some, people who are into other cult shows are really getting into Lost because their favorite actors are popping up. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Lance Reddick, who is on The Wire, the whole series,
mm-hmm.
is now kind of it's kind of interesting. He's now sort of a mysterious villain on this new season of Lost, and
right.
so that's fun for viewers. So Lost is a definite purchase. It's a definite purchase if you're a fan of the show, period. And if you're just getting into the Blu-ray technology, it you need to get this on Blu-ray. It's just
Do you think, Aaron, that they took some lessons from the X-Files because they never had an end game and they decided if they have an end game and like an end story, that would be much more beneficial to them instead of just like season after season?
He claims he does, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He does have an end game.
It's murky. I mean, I question that. Throughout the history of this series, I'm like, are they grasping at straws? Is this all going to come together? It just seems insurmountable.
I think they went to Stephen King for help when they were having like a lot of trouble back in the
day. Yeah, and how long has it been since his books have come together?
I wish I could crank out stuff like that.
Who wouldn't want to be Stephen King? But
yeah.
I've read Insomnia and some other of his books in the past decade or so, and they're all over the place.
They are. No, you're right. Some of those later ones are.
And he really let the I know some real diehard fans are really disappointed on where the Dark Tower saga went off the rails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
Speaking of going off the rails,
okay.
What's our next
video? Well, see, now here we can get into a little back and forth here, Jamie, because let's do Tropic Thunder, which I got on Blu-ray and you got standard def.
Right.
So we essentially have, I guess you could say, the same edition. I think the Blu-ray has a little more, you could say, blooper gag reels and so forth, but you know, we still got the film and the commentaries. So in Tropic Thunder, I did not see it in theaters. It just got away from me, and so I finally caught up with it. And I think it's an exercise, a terrific exercise in form, in that it every piece of that comedy fits beautifully together.
Right.
Stiller gets everything right, even the use of period music for Vietnam montages or war montages, you know, be it Sympathy for the Devil or by the Rolling Stones or the Buffalo Springfield song. And it's just a beautifully mounted film.
Yeah.
And at times it's hysterically funny, but then there are stretches where there are no laughs, and you just find yourself, you're really just marveling at how well put together it is. I think it's a film... It's a case where, this might sound perverse, where it being so well put together might have actually hurt it a little.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You and I have that same opinion. And, see, I think that it's an incredibly intelligent, insightful movie that probably reads funnier on paper than it did in execution. It's just one of those things. There are some hysterical parts in it, you're right.
I think the Tom Cruise stuff is really the brains behind the whole thing. I couldn't stop laughing during that.
That didn't really impress me.
Okay, all right.
I don't know why.
I think we all can agree that the one consistent thing that's funny, where we laugh every time, is Robert Downey Jr.
Oh, he's perfect. Yeah. This was his year.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone would deny
that. I don't know what it was. I laughed more at Matthew McConaughey in that film than I did Tom Cruise.
Well, I think you were relieved for him. When you take Kate Hudson out of the picture, he's really funny. When you take her out of the picture, dude, this guy's actually pretty funny.
Well, my favorite scene...
Dead weight away from him.
My favorite scene is the... where Ben Stiller calls him after killing the panda.
Yeah.
And he mistakes it for thinking he killed a hooker named Amanda.
Yeah.
And he has a plan. He's been through this before, so, okay, here's what you do.
And
which
also,
I think is hysterical.
And also, I think we can, there could be an argument made, I'm not going to make it, but there could be an argument made that possibly the opening fake trailers rival the Grindhouse fake trailers.
They're very funny.
You'll hear no disagreement. I think you have a very good point there. Very strong case to make, actually.
Yeah.
And, so Tropic Thunder is good. I think it is good. The Blu-ray is so I do recommend it. I do recommend a film. I don't think I still think Pineapple Express is the comedy of the year.
Yes! Thank you so much, Aaron. That's what I wanted to hear.
I saw it
so
twice.
That's as a film, though. That's as a film for Tropic Thunder. In terms of the DVD, would you agree that the highlight of the extras is probably the commentary where Downey Jr. does it in character?
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the great, like the Spinal Tap commentary and like some of the Bruce Campbell commentaries or the Clooney commentaries, which are very jocular in nature. It is one of the great commentaries, one of the great stunt commentaries. Probably ranked with Schizopolis.
It's there right in the film when Downey Jr. says, I don't get out of character until after I've done the DVD commentary. So there is a reason for it. And it really starts a whole trend. I mean, it doesn't start it. It continues the whole trend where movies are now very self-aware. They wink at you and they kind of make fun of the conventions of movies. And it's something that this one was a lot more successful than something like a typical Hollywood movie, like a What Just Happened or something like that.
Right.
I think.
But that's not a bad movie, What Just Happened. But you're right. I mean, that went nowhere. But
well, I saw it, and it was okay. It was okay.
Yeah.
It's just well, and What Just Happened, a small scale kind of personal, insidery look where.
Yes. Art Linson, yeah.
Tropic Thunder, it's doing a lot of things on a lot of levels, and maybe
yeah.
it's trying to do too much. It's trying to blow the lift off egomania and actors,
mm-hmm.
off of 24/7 celebrity culture, off of, and then on top of it, it's trying to just obliterate what was once a sacred cow, the Vietnam War,
right,
the Vietnam
right.
War movies, and it's doing that, and so it succeeds on its levels. At intermittent times, at different, you know, it's never all on, you know, rocketing on all cylinders, but it is constantly giving you something to be a look at, listen to, and then there are those times when it really does click. I mean, a character that did grow in hilarity because of his desperation and his self-absorption is the Jack Black character.
Right.
As that goes along, that really does get funny.
Right.
And that's a very interesting thing to see is that, I mean, Jack Black, here he is in a film. I mean, it's another meta moment where here he is in a film with Robert Downey Jr., and he's playing a character on set who's basically jonesing for a fix the whole time.
Right, right.
So I'm sure there are moments when Robert Downey Jr. is like, I recognize that.
He has some great moments in the movie.
Yeah.
Okay, so is it a recommend if you like the film? Or
if
you
like
haven't
the film,
it out,
it's a recommend, and the Blu-ray is really spectacular. John Tall's cinematography is
yeah.
probably underrated because it's so good. It's
yeah.
It's so,
mm-hmm.
The jungle photography is just spectacular.
Okay, what's next on our list
and
here?
Finally, and it, you brought up an interesting point. We'll talk Dark Knight, which once
mm-hmm.
again, I have the Blu-ray, you have the standard definition. And I think, I don't know, have you heard of this movie?
I had not heard of it until I saw it the other night, actually.
Okay, so yeah. So it's a little arty project. Nolan,
yeah,
Christopher Nolan did Memento and Following and the Prestige, and it's not bad. It had its moments, but
yeah.
In all seriousness, I mean, Dark Knight. We can get into like a news item, a couple of news items here. One, sold 600,000 Blu-ray units on its first day,
mm.
not in a week, which Iron Man sold 500,000 in a week.
Mm-hmm.
This did 600,000 in one day, according
right.
to sources. So obviously, it is the Blu-ray of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Probably,
I would say so.
The home video of the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the Matrix for DVD. It's probably going to be the first title to break a million. So this will be a landmark one.
Oh, I think it's the watershed release for Blu-ray, without a doubt.
It is.
Yeah.
And so what's interesting, you brought up about the Downey doing the in-character commentary. One of the things that the Blu-ray of Dark Knight is allowing on the BD Live kind of network is that people who buy it, they can do their own video commentaries, their own commentaries for the film, because the film
right.
does not have a commentary, so people can do their own. So we should start a countdown to when does the first commentary with someone pretending to be the Joker does a commentary on the film. Because, you know, there is a fan geek boy out there who is lonely and desperate enough who will do this.
Yes.
Jerry?
And Jerry, not to single you out.
No, I wouldn't do it. First of all, I'm not a big, I don't listen to commentaries that much. I don't watch, you know, the extras that much. So, I wouldn't be the one to do this. You wouldn't want me to do this.
Well, we wouldn't want you to do it.
No, I wouldn't want to fucking do it. No way.
You'd be awesome.
All right. Okay. So Dark Knight, the extras, people have complained about a lack of extras. What are they like
that.
On the Blu-ray?
It's the same extras, except for the BD Live enhancements. I think the extras are just fine. It's like, I think, an hour and a half of featurettes and behind-the-scenes stuff. Obviously, I think what people are mad about is that there's really nothing on Heath Ledger.
Right.
But let's be honest. This is not going to be the only Dark Knight release. My guess is that once the third Batman film comes out, we will get that new, we will get that Batman trilogy box, you know, that'll have everything. Because apparently, and this is goes in, on a side note, they are going to be releasing the first Batman anthology films, the you know, the 89 to 97 ones.
Yeah.
The Burtons and the Schumacher ones. Those are coming out on Blu-ray, so that'll be its own box. So I think when the third Batman film comes out, then we will get the big motherlode box with everything. So as extras go, this is really, I mean, it's a really nice package. It's a great-looking DVD. The Blu-ray, and we talked about this before, Jamie, and on the Blu-ray, and some people complain about this too. I like it because I think it's a nice thing to do. Because the film, because some of the sequences were shot for IMAX,
right,
the widescreen, the paneling, opens up depending on what sequence it is. So if it's just the regular, you know, kind of the conversational scenes, it's in the widescreen, I think, 2:35 format with the big black bars. But when it goes to the IMAX stuff, they try to reproduce that box look that IMAX has, and then it goes into a 1.781 framing, which is similar to what you see on when you buy TV shows on DVD with the minor black bars on top, or when you see on TV like Sopranos or Deadwood. So it automatically goes back and forth, and I think this is a good thing, but I have heard some DVD people find that this drives them nuts because they're constantly readjusting. But
right.
I think it was a no-win situation. If they hadn't attempted to do this, people would have said, why didn't you calibrate the formats?
Well, which is what I say about the commentary, because Chris Nolan has done commentary on several of his films, and he's very good.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like his biggest success, he doesn't do it. And I'm curious as to why. I can kind of understand his take on the deleted scenes, because he thinks deleted scenes are an insult to the actor's work, and
right,
in a way, that was his excuse for that. Or behind the scenes kinds of stuff that go into Heath Ledger's performance and what it took to create that. It feels like it's breaking down the illusion somehow. I can take that too, but his commentaries are just wonderful. So I miss that.
I do believe that when, you know, time has passed, and also, like I said, I think they're just erring on the side of caution when it comes to showing deleted scenes or behind the scenes stuff with Heath Ledger. I think he's gonna wait till the mania, if you will, dies down and people will start looking at the film again as a film.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what's gonna happen, and then we'll get something a little more elaborate. It's my guess, because I mean, Batman Begins had come out originally in 2005 on DVD, but then when The Dark Knight was coming out, it came out a nice, you know, repackaged, very nice Blu-ray and a new DVD. So I predict a box set, you know, in about 2-3 years. But mm-hmm. in the meantime, I'm sure you would agree on the standard definition, and I definitely agree on the Blu-ray, that it is worth recommending.
Oh, yeah. And it doesn't need our recommendation.
No.
Yeah, I would say it really doesn't need it at all.
It's a no-brainer.
We'll have I'm sure at the end, when we do our year-end show, we'll have a discussion. Obviously, this is the number one selling DVD and the number one release of the year, but when it comes to, like, restoration and presentation, you know, this is probably a top 10 placement, but there
yeah.
are far more elaborate and better packages out there. And so we'll get
and by far, as a film, it's at least, in the least, it's in the top five best movies of the year, I would think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Watching it again last night, you know, it's awfully pretentious a lot of times when people make the post 9/11 war in Iraq parallels to films. But I think it's absolutely relevant with The Dark Knight, no matter what Chris Nolan says. And it's ironic that those themes are best expressed in what is essentially a superhero movie. You know.
Yeah, I think he's smart to try to downplay it.
Yeah.
And let the fans and the critics do that, most of that jockeying on that front. So I think he's smart. He's very shrewd in doing that. And so I commend him for not, you know, throwing more, you know, fuel on the fire.
Right.
So,
it's all true to the story. It's all true to the ideas they're exploring. There's nothing that takes you out just to make a modern commentary. But I mean, the anarchy and how far you have to go to defeat it, and whether that's worth it,
mm-hmm.
you know. I think that's a very, and the whole thing of if you live to long enough, you'll find yourself become a villain, you know.
Right.
Start the hero.
And
that's
also
very pertinent ideas for today.
And also the whole notion of anarchy in a community being gripped by fear, but then also the triumph of a community coming together
yeah.
through that fear
right.
to stand up to it. And to me, the one of the great moments in the film by Heath Ledger is a look of disappointment when involving the fairy.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
He's actually
right.
It's a great moment in that yes, he's disappointed, but also, and this is the real perverse part, you actually for a moment feel bad for him and feel pity on him because he is so disappointed,
yes.
and he has the great toss-off line: if you want anything done, you want something done, you got to do it yourself. And there is great, great pity and sorrow in his look, and that's a great moment.
Yeah,
in a
very
big
inventive, very inventive performance. Jerry, I got to tell you something. My computer just crashed.
Mm-hmm.
I need you to log into the switchboard.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with the Blog Talk Radio. My computer just crashed.
Okay.
So now I'll log on as soon as I get this back up and running.
All right.
All right, Aaron, thank you so much. Any upcoming releases prior to Christmas that we're excited about DVD-wise?
DVD-wise, what is coming up? Well, Paramount is going to be putting out a bunch of catalog films on Blu-ray, which is quite fascinating. And so they're really ramping up their home entertainment, which I got to give them credit for because they're usually the worst at it. But they really seem to have, it looks like they're trying to turn a corner on this. And I've gotten a couple of those, and they've been looking quite terrific. Particularly Truman Show looks really, really, really spectacular. And Jamie, your favorite film, Ghost, looks terrific on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Gary doesn't know if I'm being serious or if I'm joking. So.
Yeah, he's joking.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, buddy, and we look forward to hearing from you again at the end of the year. We'll run down the top 10 DVD releases of the year and top 10 films, and
y'all
it'll
be
good
on.
Times.
All right.
Thanks,
thank
buddy.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, this is Aaron Onadiaz with the DVD report. Sorry about my technical problems. I got eaten up by some virus again last night. My computer, I need a new computer because it completely shut down. I'm having to recover my system in the middle of the show. Are you there, Jerry? Okay, we don't have Jerry here. And I'm unable to get on the chat room, so I don't know if we're live or not. So hold on real quick. We'll be right back with director Rod Lurie.
You there, Jamie? Are you on? Hello, Jamie? Hello, Jamie.
Yes.
You got, all right, because I had, you're on two lines, you realize that?
Probably.
Yeah, okay.
But I'll operate from this line now. Are we live? Can people
hear?
We
are live.
Okay. Sorry if there was an abundance of dead air. I couldn't hear you. That your line wasn't coming through.
There's a couple of issues with this thing as usual. All right, but I can hear you now though.
Okay, but this has to do with my computer. It's not anything else. My computer it's dying. Okay, so we have an exciting interview for you guys tonight before we get into our Golden Globe roundtable. And that is with director Rod Lurie. He's a terrific talent, a writer-director who makes real great, terrific films of great ideas. And his latest film is nothing but the truth, and it's the story of a CIA operative who was ousted by an ambitious journalist. And his other films include The Last Castle, Robert Redford, and The Contender with Joan Allen and Jeff Bridges, a tremendous film there. And, of course, he's made a great impact on television as well with his series Commander-in-Chief with Gina Davis as the president. Very smart guy. And we want to play this interview for you. It's in two parts, Jerry, and I'll tell you when the second part comes up. But for right now, let's play the first part. Lurie 1 is the file name.
Here we go. Enjoy, guys.
Tell me, I believe I read that your father was a cartoonist. Political cartoonist?
He was a political cartoonist, and if you believe the Guinness Book of World Records for like a decade or even 20 years, I think, he was the number one political cartoonist on Earth. You know, it was really cool because he was really influential, and so we had the generals and congressmen and senators and governors walking through our homes. I think he interviewed every world leader imaginable. You know, everybody from Anwar Sadat to Idi Amin. It was to Reagan. So it was very cool growing up in that environment.
I bet it was. So that's what inspired you politically, but what about in terms of films and filmmaking? When did that spark strike for you?
No, it's, I don't understand why not everybody is really interested in being a filmmaker or in being a film. Who doesn't like going to movies, man? You know, I grew up in the mid-70s, right? So, I remember, my dad taking me when I was 11 years old. My first R-rated film was The Godfather 2. And I saw that the same day I saw The Conversation. Then a couple of days later, it was Christmas break. I saw Chinatown. And then you got those years in 75 where, you got Dog Day Afternoon and Cuckoo's Nest. And then in 76, you got President's Man. And so I grew up in a really amazing era of filmmaking. And I absolutely just, fell in love with it. And it was... I thought being a film critic, you must be the coolest guy in the world because the coolest thing in the world to do was to go to the movies, and therefore, whoever did it for a living must be the coolest cat in town.
Right.
And which is what made me become a film critic. I honestly thought that being a film critic would get me laid.
Might have had better luck than me.
Yeah, it didn't really work out that way, my friends. I thought that I would be able to go to the gorgeous Russian model and say, hey, guess what? I got advanced screening tickets to go see, the new Andrew McCarthy film. It didn't really work out that way.
Well, those are really life-changing movies that you mentioned.
Yeah,
I mean,
you grew up at the right time.
Oh, my son right now is 18 and makes fun of my age, all the time. And I like to tell him, listen, we're going to live the same amount of years probably. So, it doesn't really matter when that occurs. The difference is that you grew up watching, The Mummy movies, and I went to see Taxi Driver when it came out. So,
yeah.
So there.
I'll take Taxi Driver.
Yeah, any day. And do you feel like the youth of today or the moviegoer of today, they're really missing something because those are the kinds of movies that rule at the theater now?
I really do, guys. It's a bummer what's out there. There are of course several good movies and several good filmmakers, and it's very exciting when Paul Thomas Anderson comes out with you know, a brand new movie, and it's really exciting when Tarantino does a new film. But you know, there are. I once said that that there are no mavericks out there, and what I meant was that the studio system does not like maverickism in its movies or in its directors. And so, really, you have to go into the independent world. Remember that that's really where Tarantino began, and really where Anderson began. You know, these really, really, you know, and Alexander Payne. You know, the guys who are the star quality filmmakers of today. And the studios, you know, don't want to take really that many chances. And so, and now the independent film companies are falling apart like they're zeros over Midway. You know, they're just they're going down. And we're going to start seeing less and less of these quality independent films. The point is that the studios made Network, and the studios made Taxi Driver, and the studio made All the President's Men.
Right,
the studio
it's a different
men
era.
Made, you know, and they were willing to make those films, and the audiences, for some reason back then, you know, completely gravitated toward them. All the President's Men probably made the equivalent of $200 million.
Right.
You know,
you
know.
You speak of mavericks, but we've always considered you a maverick on this show.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, it's but I'm not making studio films.
But
my next film is going to be a studio film, and I got a very ballsy studio head who's going to give me a lot of you know, a lot of rain when I make it. And it's
is that Straw Dogs you're talking about? Or?
Yeah, you know and that film was a tiny bit before my time. It came out when I was 9 years old, and I didn't get to see it in the theaters, but. You know. Hopefully, we'll be able to make a studio film that has the guts and the energy of the independent of an independent film.
Right.
I want to get to Nothing But the Truth as soon as possible. But since we brought up Straw Dogs, let me ask you one question. In your mind, in your script, where do you see the relevancy of that story to today?
Well, you know, first of all, it's a really great story, and. You know, that I think is kind of an evergreen. But, you know, back in its day, some people made, you know, a Vietnam analogy to it. And I suppose what you're asking is, what would be the modern analogy?
Mm-hmm.
And my answer is, I don't think it was a Vietnam analogy. You know, there's nothing in the literature about that. And Peckinpah, when interviewed, always poo-pooed the idea. And, you know, he just wanted to tell, you know, a really good story and a story about human character. And I look at it as, you know, as a movie that is a sort of a personification about. I want to, you know, it's difficult to say because people always sort of jump. Every word I say about this movie, people jump out and say that the filmmaker doesn't understand the movie. You know, he's going to, you know, take him completely the wrong direction. But I really look at it as a movie about. You know, human cruelty, and how we really are all capable of it, and that decency really is the magic of not allowing our baser instincts to take over. And so, you know, I'm gonna, you know, and I think that all the characters in the film have some amount of culpability in how the film ends. Not in the rape scene, which is the most famous, but in the big shootout at the end of the film.
Well, Jerry and I both have talked about it, and we're really looking forward to it. We're not precious at all about a remake of Straw Dogs like some people are. So
you know what's interesting is the film is not necessarily a great film by any stretch of the imagination. It's not as good. You know, I wouldn't dare to remake The Wild Bunch. And
I agree with you there. I agree with you 100% there.
He was infamously, you know, hospitalized. For you know, his drunkenness or his alcohol intake when he made that film, and you can see that there's some things that are rather incomprehensible in the film. I do think that Peckinpah had a certain level of genius, and you know my favorite film of his is not The Wild Bunch. It's the director's cut of Major Dundee. Although I love The Wild Bunch as well, and but you know he made a lot of films that were. You know, let's say of less than stellar quality, like for example, the Killer Elite, and or Bring Me to the Head of Alfredo Garcia. Now, you know, they're not really at the height of filmmaking. Even Cross of Iron, I didn't care for too much.
Oh, well, I like Cross of Iron, but you know, The Wild Bunch is the only movie he made straight. He was not.
Yeah, that's
drunk
probably.
Or stoned. That was the only movie he made straight. So, and you know,
I didn't know that. I wasn't aware of that, but that makes a lot. That certainly makes a lot of sense to me. And it's interesting. We're thinking about who we want to cast right now. It's a long process. We want to do right. We want to do something that's really exciting.
Yeah.
When we cast it, we want whoever we choose to be a shock to the system, and we're going to do something very exciting with the movie. I think so. We'll see.
I'm terribly excited about it.
I'm very curious what your take will be.
your films. You've done all kinds of films. We're talking about Straw Dogs, and you look at The Last Castle, and you look at Resurrecting the Champ. We spoke to Alison Burnett around the time of Resurrecting the Champ.
Right.
But do you find, because in my mind, this is what I think about you too, is it a curse to be known as primarily as a political filmmaker, or is it something you embrace?
Well, I'll tell you something. That's a really good question that nobody's ever asked me, and I'm really happy to answer it. And that is this. I think it's a bit of a curse at this point, because nobody really thinks that I can do anything outside of that box. Even my big action film, The Last Castle, certainly had political overtones, and those tones were about leadership, which ultimately is about politics.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'll tell you this much. I wrote a screenplay, which is the remake of Frank Capra's movie State of the Union, and we got actors started to become very attracted to it. It's a really good screenplay, but it's a political film. And I made the decision, much to the chagrin, I think, of my producers, that I didn't want to make the film because I wanted to make something that was just not political. I just couldn't do it again. Because I also have that TV series, Commander-in-Chief, right, which is going to be more political. And so that's why I made the decision to proceed with Straw Dogs as my next film. You know, and so you're right that, it does become a bit of a curse, on the other hand, I'll always be employed because whenever any script comes out that is, has some politics to it, they go to a few people, probably I'm third place after Oliver Stone or Aaron Sorkin or maybe, or a couple of other people. But, I'm happy to be a go-to guy. I just don't want to make every film about that.
It's good to have a niche, as long as you can have the freedom occasionally to get out of it.
You predated the Sarah Palin thing a good 8 years.
What's that?
Predated Sarah Palin a good, well, in one sense, The Contender was way ahead of its time.
Right. Well, I looked at, The Contender, a lot of people view that as a movie that used as its model the Lewinsky scandal, and really, I was looking at it more as Clarence Thomas, which is, I asked myself at the time the question, what would happen if Clarence Thomas was a woman? And a woman had to deal with all these embarrassing sexual questions, and could the country stomach it?
She was your best friend.
This was Brendan deposed Will's ex-wife today, and she stated that Will and I had had an affair.
She saw her fucking holding hands, interlocked fingers with this gal, and she knew that she'd been fucking him. That's what he said.
Sorry.
It's a bad beat.
Not sure that I get the point of all this.
You said under oath you never committed adultery.
That's right.
You perjured yourself.
I didn't commit adultery.
You were fucking Will when he was married.
All right, Kay.
Even the most loose definition of committing adultery would not include that.
Kay, goddamn it, she's right. You're right, Lyon. In order for her to be committing adultery, she'd have to be married at the time. You're nitpicking in reverse now. Your husband may be an adulterer, you're not. Fine. What you are is a sex-crazed home-wrecking machine. The female Warren Beatty.
Although, there is an interesting analogy to Nothing But the Truth with Sarah Palin, which is, this is a movie about a woman who goes to jail to protect a source. Nothing But the Truth is. And in this movie, she more or less loses her son in the process. And people criticize her for it in the film, and also, in real life, people say, well, I would never leave my son. It must be a bad mother. And I was thinking about Palin when she first came on the scene, and everybody was talking about all her kids and what a terrible mother. She's going to be vice president, which means she cannot pay attention to her kids.
Right.
And, but first of all, there's some silliness there because the vice president has far fewer duties than a governor. However, look at Obama Obama's got girls that are 10 and 7, and nobody's saying to him, what kind of father are you? You're going to be president of the United States while you're supposed to be raising your kids.
Right.
And there's a certain amount of sexism involved there, I think. And
absolutely.
That, you know, and that is, you know, Kate Beckinsale makes a big speech about that in Nothing But the Truth, that she's away from her family. Alan Alda, who plays her attorney, says, your son is growing up without you. And she tells him, listen, when men go to jail to protect a principle, they build statues to them. And when they go to war and abandon their families, they build named highways after them. A woman does that, and she's, you know, some sort of monster. And that really is it's a bizarre thing, but it's true. And, you know, the movie deals with it a little bit.
All right. In the second half of our conversation with Mr. Lorre, he continues to discuss Nothing But the Truth and also spend some time describing his show Commander-in-Chief. It was a highly successful series, and it was taken from him in midstream and given to another high-profile producer. So let's listen to this, part two of our conversation with Rod Lorre.
Okay.
Well, this movie also deals with, obviously, First Amendment issues,
right.
Journalism. Let me ask you about both of these topics.
Mm-hmm.
Because the First Amendment rights have really kind of come under fire since the administration that's now moving out, thank God. And I'm wondering, do you find that that deterioration of those rights is indicative of this administration, or that it's something in the culture where we've been moving towards that? Do you think it'll get better?
I think that's an extremely interesting question, because I just wrote an article for the Huffington Post that deals with this, which is
mm-hmm.
this. The film has gotten, Nothing But the Truth has gotten extremely good reviews, and we're very happy with them. But there have been one or two of the misguided, so to speak. And in one of those reviews, the reviewer said, well, the film goes off the liberal rails. In other words,
right.
it's that the issue of the federal shield law, which would protect journalists from being thrown into jail if they don't reveal their sources, this reviewer, this woman, was assuming that it's a liberal issue, maybe because I'm a liberal. But it's not at all a liberal issue. It is, in fact, in the Congress right now, it's 176 Republicans have voted to not allow journalists to be thrown into jail. And the people that are running sort of this gauntlet are Republican Senators Spector and Lugar. So I would say that this is specific to an administration, that there's something about the culture that George Bush and Dick Cheney have sort of brewed over the years. They're so secretive, so power-hungry, so unsure of themselves that they feel that they need to hide facts from the American people and do things covertly. So it's very possible the Democrats, if they're behaving improperly, will also want to, make sure that, journalists don't have the ability to rat them out.
Well, you mentioned liberalism,
mm-hmm.
And obviously that's something that's been thrown against you and most filmmakers that attempt any kind of political-themed movie. I'm wondering if you go out of your way to avoid any semblance of a liberal bias.
Well, actually, you know, the contender was very liberal and was a very anti-Republican, and you know, I make no bones about it, and I'm absolutely fine with it. The character played by Matt Dillon, who is the federal prosecutor in Nothing But the Truth, is a Democrat. So, I actually created the only true adversary in the film is a Democrat and is a liberal. But, you know, does believe, in national security and does believe that national security trumps, First Amendment rights. So,
yeah.
I didn't really go out of my way. There's no liberal or conservative issue in this film. It just doesn't exist. It's an issue about the power versus the powerful versus the powerless.
Right.
You know, the powerful can be Democrats.
Yeah, is it more important as a filmmaker when you're dealing with these kinds of issues in your films to raise the issue, to ask the question, and it's less important to kind of offer solutions or answer those questions?
We certainly don't have solutions in this film, and it's ending, it creates a tremendous, I don't want to say ambiguity, but it makes people refocus their attention on what the movie's been about the entire time, for its entire length. And, so the ending of Nothing But the Truth is not intended necessarily to give answers, but I'll tell you what, it really, and I've been witness to this, gets people talking for hours.
That's good.
You know, trying to, I'm sorry?
That's very good. That it gets
no, that's very good.
I thought your film is a success.
Yeah, you know, it's, I'm sort of very grateful to the reaction to the film because, you know, whenever you put on a sort of a twist ending, you're taking a big risk because some people may say that it's no good or that they saw it coming, but that doesn't really seem to be the case with this film. So, you know, I feel very blessed from that point of view.
Well, the other thing is the journalism issue, and I know Kate Beckinsale, she did shadow some journalists in her preparation of this.
Right. Yeah.
And another shift that has occurred possibly that correlates to this, have you noticed more and more kind of soft journalism?
I thought you were going to ask me something else. Have you noticed more and more really hot journalists in that? When we were on the set, the guy from Washington Post was there, and he took me aside. He said, "You know, the one real flaw you have is that, you know, these journalists, they don't look like Kate Beckinsale." And
right.
I just thought, you know, poor Kate, the poor girl. No matter what role she plays, she's not. She's too good looking for this to play that kind of person. She's too good looking to be anything. You know what? She was too good looking to play Ava Gardner in the 80s.
That's true.
You know, she's too good looking to play a movie star. You know, it's kind of a pain in the ass for her. I think, and I think it's a real problem for her, and one of the big stepping stones for her will be to do a film in which her beauty is not exploited, as it has been in almost everything that she's done, either playing the beautiful wife or the vampire hunter in the skin-tight clothes.
Right,
and she's a good and compelling and charismatic actress, but, you know, she has definitely been typecast.
I work for the National Desk.
Okay.
And it's going to run tomorrow, and it's going to say, among other things, that you are a CIA operative. That you went on a mission, a fact-finding mission to Venezuela.
What?
Hear me out, okay? You went there on a fact-finding mission to determine if its government was responsible for the assassination attempt on President Lyman. You determined it was not, and you informed your bosses of this.
This is the stupidest BS I have ever heard.
Wait.
What? Can you? How do I know that you're from the Sun-Times?
The White House ignored your findings and launched an attack anyway, still claiming retribution for the assassination attempt. I've been on the National Desk for 5 years. I have a column every Tuesday on the editorial page. My son goes to school here too.
Yeah, no, you said that.
She's very good. She just got a nomination yesterday, I believe.
Yeah.
Broadcast Film Critics.
Yeah, and that's the biggest critics organization in the world, really. And so, we're really grateful for that. And so did the great Vera Farmiga, the CIA agent in the film.
Right.
Yeah, another wonderful actress, and they've both worked with Scorsese. I think I read that Scorsese was the one that urged you to go with Kate for the film.
Well, yeah, you know, he was, and it was really funny because when I called him to talk to him about Kate and Vera. In the middle of the conversation, he says to me, "Wait a second, have you offered this to Kate yet?" And I said, "No." He goes, "Well, go do it immediately." And, you know, it was really funny because it was like God telling me to do something. I hung up the phone and just made the offer. I didn't even think about all the other actresses that were on the line. As Scorsese says, you know, he's a pretty good caster. If he says hire her, you know, off I went to the races.
Oh, yeah,
and,
you can't question that, yeah.
And he loves Vera Farmiga. You know, I'll tell you a quick story about the woman we call the great Vera.
Sure.
There's a scene in the movie where she takes a lie detector test, right? And so I brought in a real polygraphist to do the test, and he hooks her up and puts her through the control questions, shows her the machine is working, and now she's answering the questions, right? And the questions are, "Is your name Erica Van Doren?" That's her character name. She says, "Yes." "Are you in the CIA?" "Yes." Blah, blah, blah. Now the scene is over, And the polygraphist calls me over, and he says, and he's laughing. He says, she passed the test. So Vera's answering the questions and saying that she's really, and she really believes she's Erica Van Doren when she's doing the scene.
Now that's an actress right there. That's acting right there.
That is.
Yeah,
that is.
You know. Yeah. She should actually become a CIA agent. She'd be fantastic.
I bet. Let me ask you about one other collaborator that you've worked with.
Mm-hmm.
I think twice now, if I'm not mistaken, and that's Alan Alda. Am I correct about that?
Yeah.
I love Alan Alda. I mean, you see him on screen and you just feel at home with him. And I'm wondering what appeals to you about him working with him.
What you just said is really part of it. When Alan Alda arrives on screen, it's like a warm blanket. The audience can
mm-hmm.
settle and be relaxed and know the
right.
performance is going to be great, and that there's probably going to be some humor connected with it. And that's exactly what happens. You know, when he arrives on screen, we've had audiences that clap. Now, those are audiences that know that Alan Alda's coming to speak to them. But, mm-hmm. you know, there's just a sense of warmth, associated with him. He is, to me, one of the great screen actors and one of the great television actors of all time. I always loved Alan Alda, but then I assumed he was one of the greats when he did Crimes and Misdemeanors. And,
oh, of course.
You know, he is so good. And when Alan said yes to doing Resurrecting the Champ, I just couldn't believe it. And I remember finishing that film and saying to myself, you know, I can't believe I just worked with Alan Alda. And then, after doing Nothing But the Truth, I say, I can't believe that Alan Alda is my friend.
Yeah.
And it's just, he's the nicest guy, you know, that you'll ever meet. He really is his persona.
Mm-hmm.
And, he's got a beautiful wife, Arlene, and she writes children's books, and Vera Farmiga in the movie reads Arlene's book to kids. It's just great, you know. I love working with that guy, you know.
Mr. Burnside, this is a real honor for me. I studied you growing up. My dad was also a lawyer.
This is a big mistake, Patton.
Well, there's nothing like learning from our mistakes.
Yeah, well, sometimes a mistake is like wearing white after Labor Day, and sometimes a mistake is invading Russia in winter.
I like actors in general. You know, I like hanging out with them. They're a little a bit insane, but you know, to the women. But I do like them.
What have you learned? Yeah, go ahead, Jerry, please.
I just want to ask a question, and it's probably the elephant in the room kind of question. But I just want to: how much is Kate Beckinsale's character in Nothing But the Truth based on Judith Miller, if at all?
Well, it's not an elephant in the room because we've talked about it before. Here's what I would say. It's not based on Judith Miller, a lick, not the character. The situation is based on a situation that Judith Miller went through and that Valerie Plame went through. But, you know, Kate is not Judith Miller, not by any stretch of the imagination, you know.
Right,
indeed,
okay.
Kate met with Judith Miller, but it's really to discuss what it was like to be a female journalist from a high-profile paper in a jail. She just wanted to get some of some insight into that, but she wasn't there to study her mannerisms. She wasn't there to study, anything about Judy Miller,
right.
Really. And I certainly didn't. Yeah, but it is a bit of a thorn in my side because I didn't realize how much antipathy there is toward Judith Miller, maybe take it out on us a little bit. We'll see.
But this was actually an idea that you came up with. It was a subplot on Commander in Chief, I believe.
That's right. Yeah.
Thrown out by the subsequent. Subsequent.
You're right. I was on Commander in Chief. I came up with an idea about a journalist going to jail, and I was fired from that show. Stephen Bochco came in and took over, and basically set on fire every idea that I had, and so now there are all these ideas for. I got enough ideas now for the next 15 movies because.
Well, that's something you got out of that. That's,
yeah. Yeah, that's good. That's good.
That was a very brutal time of my life because, the show was a massive success.
Yeah.
Everybody was riding high, and I get a surprise phone call on October 6th. I remember it was my son's birthday party, and telling me you need to go get fired. And I remember meeting with the head of the studio, and I said to him, what do you do to the guy who gives you the number two new show? Does he actually get shot? I mean, what do you, I don't understand.
It was
baffling to me at the time, and still baffles me somewhat.
It was mind-boggling to me, too.
Likewise.
They paid for it, too, in the ratings, so...
Well, I mean, the show went from being the number one new show to being number 72 in the ratings and canceled. It's almost unheard of in the history of television. But when they brought Stephen in, I remember the president of ABC called me and said, "Listen, it's going to be the same show." You know, which begs the question, why don't you just keep the same person on? But I knew that it couldn't possibly be the same show because Stephen Boschko doesn't do Rod Lurie shows; he does Stephen Boschko shows, and that's not what the show was. And the audience has rejected it with immediacy. They wanted out right away.
Back to Nothing But the Truth. Let me just close with this question. We talked about the response to the film and the fact that it inspires conversation, which is great for any film. What do you want that conversation to be? What do you want audiences to take away from it when they watch it?
You know, I don't want them to. It's not a message film. It's not a Broccoli movie. It's not a movie necessarily meant to educate anybody. What I want them to go away with, believe it or not, is to talk about the movie in particular and what motivated the character. After they see the ending, I want them to sit down at dinner and say, okay, what really was she going through? What really was in her mind during the entire movie? Let's go over the movie again in our mind. In fact, let's go pay tickets and go see it again so that we can sort of understand really what was going on with Rachel Armstrong. I really want them to walk away from this movie because it is a piece of entertainment. And, there's nothing highfalutin about it. It's a story, and I want them to re-examine the story.
Yeah, and it's a great story. And Rod, let me tell you, we love your work, and we believe in you a lot, and keep on trucking. We're here for you.
Well, yeah, we are.
Listen, I love movie geeks. My son is one. So my son would love to have your job, I'll tell you that.
Alan Rickman, actually, at the end of our interview with him last week. He said, I want to be an honorary movie geek. So, really? It's spreading.
It is spreading, no doubt.
Let's spread the word about the movie geeks.
Absolutely, come back and talk to us around Straw Dogs time. We'd love to hear from you.
Let's do it. We'll yap again after we do that movie. You tell me whether or not it worked for you or not. Okay.
All right. Okay. Thank you, my friend.
Bye, guys.
Okay, Rod Lurie, a great filmmaker, a great conversation, I think.
Definitely.
Did you enjoy that, Jerry?
Oh, I had a great time. Now I have a good technical question for you. Are you on back on the switchboard or?
No, it's going to be another. It's going to be about another 15 minutes until.
Okay, I want to. I think we have our very good friend
and partner on.
I'm going to patch him through. Chris, are you there?
Hey.
All right, we have Chris on the phone. Finally, a third person I want to talk to. All right, that's good. This is beautiful.
He was sitting on that intro for forever. He was thinking, "Oh, I can't wait until I get to."
He knew he was going to get a favorable reaction from me. So.
Yeah.
But that's for any time I walk in a room or go on a show. That's just how I greet people.
Yeah.
Job interviews, I don't care.
That's great. No, that's good to know.
Which explains why you're currently unemployed. So
that's exactly good.
Oh shit! I did not know that. I'm sorry.
He's joking.
Yeah, I'm joking. Yeah.
Okay, that's not something.
Chris works harder than the two of us combined, Jerry.
I'm sure he does.
Yeah. Okay, so it's Golden Globes time. Seeing that I don't have a computer, do you want if you guys have the Golden Globes?
I have it up right now, because I figured, Jamie, you wouldn't. You were with that dickless wonder earlier. You guys were insulting me about that commentary track on The Dark Knight, so I just had to get that in there.
I didn't call you that, but okay.
No holds barred with me, okay?
I understand.
Yeah, you do. All right, let's start with Best Motion Picture Drama. And I'm going to read, do you want me to read out the films and then we'll...
Yeah, we'll do a roundtable on who we think would win, who's not in the category that should be, the whole nine yards.
Okay, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Frost Nixon, The Reader, Revolutionary Road, and Slumdog Millionaire.
Mm. Yeah,
there's
Jerry,
a big one missing here. There's one.
Yeah, big elephant. Should we all just say what I think we all think are thinking? It's the same film.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
The Dark Knight.
Oh, okay.
No,
maybe we're thinking of two different movies then.
Okay, what's the film that you're thinking of then?
Well, Milk, right?
Oh no.
Yeah.
Well, both of those are the two. Either one of those films.
Yeah.
Both of those, because I think eliminating Dark Knight
was
a huge mistake. But I think Milk is even a bigger mistake because it's a really uplifting, very powerful film.
Mm-hmm.
And while I think it's great that Sean Penn is nominated, there's a lot of other great things about that film. And it's just not represented here.
They didn't seem to think so at the Golden Globes this year.
Well, can I ask you a question? What is the Hollywood Foreign Press? Does anyone know?
I really don't. I couldn't answer that question.
Are they like funded by Mossad or like the on the old Shah's Secret Service? I mean, what is the Hollywood Foreign Press?
You have got me, Jerry. I don't know.
Okay.
But they pick these films every year, and we were talking about it the other night. Sometimes there's some good surprises at the Golden Globes. But also, I often get the sense that there are movies that are being nominated. I don't know how many people vote, but don't you get the sense sometimes that they have not seen these movies? Movies like Curious Case of Benjamin Button. I can't believe that everyone that voted for that movie has actually seen it. That blows me away.
Look, I think that the Golden Globes this year are astounding for what they actually put in there. And surprisingly so, because they didn't overlook some really deserving people that I didn't think had a chance to be nominated.
Right.
We'll get into those later. But just as astounding is what's omitted here. And Milk limited to a nomination for Sean Penn is, I think, a travesty.
Mm-hmm. It is.
I'm not somebody that's going to campaign hard for Milk. I've seen Milk, and I think it's a fine movie. I think Sean Penn and Josh Brolin and Franco are very good in it.
Yes.
I think it's a little too much of a standard biopic for my taste. But it is certainly deserving of an end-of-the-year top five honors, I think,
mm-hmm.
in terms of its relevancy, in terms of its importance,
right.
and the scope of its performances and its power, its powerful message.
Doesn't it at least belong in this category as opposed to something like Revolutionary Road, which, don't get me wrong, isn't getting awful reviews, but it's definitely getting reviews that say, not quite as good as the book,
right.
good movie, doesn't
mm-hmm.
quite capture what the spirit of the book. I mean, that's pretty
well,
much
let's,
the...
Let's go with the reader, then. The reader's getting atrocious reviews.
Yeah, very similar.
And I like the reader, but I'll be very honest with you, the reviews are just not there.
Yeah. By the way, Hollywood Foreign Press Association is an organization comprising journalists who cover the United States film industry but are affiliated with publications outside North America. It was started by the Daily Mail, which is a UK newspaper.
Oh, my
and
God,
apparently
okay.
Apparently you can pay your way into it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I've heard.
I'm sure Harvey did.
But I think they nominated Revolutionary Road, and that took Milk's place, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And
Jerry, actually, I do think Jerry's right. The Dark Knight does belong to be, movies, those big movies get nominated sometimes, and, like movies like Star Wars get nominated
mm-hmm.
for Best.
Yeah.
When you look back, that doesn't seem ridiculous. You understand, because it
right.
was
well,
a
mm-hmm.
phenomenon.
I think the reason I would say, I was talking about this to someone earlier, and I've talked about it like since the movie's been released, is that this is a movie that, not just because it made an enormous amount of money, or and not only because I think it's a superb studio film, it's just everything about it I love, but it got people to go to the movies who normally, let's be honest, don't go to the movies that much. I talk with people every day about this film who, the last movie they saw, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, they just don't go to the movies that much, and that should be, I think that kind of power needs to be represented, that a movie could do that, get people out of the house.
Yeah.
So having said that, which one of these movies will win? Which one of these movies could win? Because if you take out Reader and Revolutionary Road, you're left with three movies, Benjamin Button, Frost Nixon, Slumdog Millionaire. I haven't seen, I've seen Frost Nixon, but I haven't seen the other two. But I got to say, none of them really seem like Best Picture quality, or best, they don't seem like Best Picture type movies. The the type of movie that usually wins the best picture.
Right.
I looked at three of the films on here.
Well, you're
and
beating me.
Of the three, I would say, even though I don't think it's the best film of the year, I think Slumdog seems to be the favorite.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like that's got the momentum right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Slumdog may be the one to pull it off for the Golden Globes. I think that in terms of what is most Oscar worthy, or at least in terms of its content and its range, is out of these, it's probably Benjamin Button, just because
mm-hmm.
it just tells such an epic kind of story.
Right.
I don't know once that hits people if it will hit them in a very emotional, visceral way or not, and that could determine quite a bit. Out of these, I think Slumdog is the one people are rooting for.
Yeah. Although I like Frost Nixon a lot, and I do like The Reader. The Reader doesn't really tell us anything new. And the people that I know have seen it, and I've seen a lot of people have problems with the movie, as they did with the book, that you would focus on the persecutor instead of the persecuted.
Right.
It's an odd film. When you guys get a chance to see it, I'd be curious what your reaction is, because the second half of it, like the first half of the film is like...
Son of a bitch up there with all these movies you can see whenever you want. You don't understand. We won't be able to see this movie for months.
Okay.
Months.
I got to see this in advance of this, but I'm just curious, because I think the first half plays like the Night Porter, and the second half plays like the Nasty Girl.
Well, I've seen the Night Porter. I haven't seen the Nasty Girl.
Nasty Girl's that... But that's about...
That was Joan Collins and Pia Zadora, right?
No. The Nasty Girl is actually a very good film about a town's involvement in the Holocaust. I think it's from the 80s. But that's the first thing that came to mind. But
The Night Porter is actually an apt comparison, especially to the controversy that's occurring today over the movie, which is the mixture of kind of explicit sexuality and a subplot about the Holocaust, a Nazi war criminal. That's very sensitive to some people.
Well,
that
it's that. I mean, it's that, but it's like, you could honestly just call, if you really wanted, you didn't have to call this movie The Reader, you could just call this You Never Forget Your First Girl.
Right.
And You Never Forget Your First Time.
Even if she's a Nazi, yeah.
Yeah, even if she's an SS guard.
Yeah. Now we just have that, there's the occasional role-playing where that happens.
Yeah, I know, like high anxiety.
Right. So are we all in agreement that Slumdog, the momentum's there, that'll probably be a favorite for the Globes, at least?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think so, too. But I also think we can all agree that this category, I'm assuming that none of the comedy pictures from the Globes will be nominated for Best Picture, so we got to look at the drama category, and when it comes to Oscar season, this is going to be a completely different category. I don't think it's going to look
so.
Like this.
Can we go to comedy and musical right now?
Let me just say, too, I do think the Frost Nixon's one of the best movies of the year.
It is a great movie.
Yeah.
I like Frost Nixon a lot, too, but it felt a little bit too minor of a story.
I understand.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it is, as a minor little story, a little slice of American history,
mm-hmm.
it's fascinating. And if nothing else, even if you don't like the movie, the performances are spellbinding.
Yeah, I think that's what it is, Chris. It is, especially Langella's mannerisms. He just gets all the mannerisms right. I mean, it's amazing.
He is incredible in that movie. Incredible.
He gets the kind of wounded, insecure soul.
Yeah.
I mean, he gets the weight of that man's tragedy. As did Anthony Hopkins. I mean, Anthony Hopkins, I think you can point to more as the more fledged out performance because he had the opportunity to do it. It was about Nixon and all of his foibles. But Langella gets a very poetic side of Nixon, too. And all the performances, Sam Rockwell, I was very impressed with.
Yeah, Sam Rockwell was great.
He was.
As with most Ron Howard movies, it's a great performance movie.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah. Yep. Rebecca Hall also, I should mention, looking hot again, by the way.
Yeah, no, she was good. She was very good as Frost, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, comedy category, is that what we're having
Yeah,
now?
Comedy or musical, because I think this is a fascinating category. You have Burn After Reading, which I like, but I'm not going to jump through hoops about it. Happy Go Lucky, which I thought was okay. Mamma Mia, well, is there anything Meryl Streep can't do, I think is really what the movie should be called. Vicky Cristina Barcelona, which I think all three of us like a lot.
Yes.
And then there's In Bruges, which is my favorite film of the year.
This is it. These are the surprises that I'm talking about. How they recognized Vicky Cristina across the board, and how they recognized in Bruges. I mean, I think that's wonderful.
Oh, I think it's incredible. I was shocked when I saw that.
Yeah, I think this is a real well representative category here, and I think it's going to go for the Golden Globes now. I think Mamma Mia is going to get it for the Golden Globes.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I think it's a worldwide phenomenon. I think the Golden Globes tend to be more populist, and so I think it's got that that in there.
Yeah. I would be surprised if it doesn't get it.
That being said, I think Vicky Cristina is probably in my top two of the year list for me personally.
Okay,
I mean,
I think for me,
you
did a great job talking about that, and you know, but I have to say, of in Bruges, as of right now, in Bruges is probably my favorite film of the year.
Mm.
Wow, yeah, good movie, definitely good movie.
Yeah,
but that's really high up there. But then again, it has been a strange year. A lot of the movies we thought were going to be big weren't, and vice
yeah.
versa. Who ever heard of this movie last year? Nobody.
No one, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What's our next category?
Best performance by an actress in a motion picture drama. Anne Hathaway for Rachel Getting Married, Angelina Jolie, Changeling, Meryl Streep, Doubt, Kristen Scott Thomas, I Loved You So Long, and Kate Winslet for Revolutionary Road.
Another one. Another Kristen Scott Thomas and that film being recognized.
Yes.
Another great surprise, because she wasn't, obviously we read the great reviews of her performance, but we thought it was so outside of the mindset here in
yeah.
awards time, we didn't think it would be recognized. So none yeah. of us kind of predicted this, but that's very noble of them. I think that it's going to be the last one you mentioned.
Kate Winslet, you think for Revolutionary Road?
I think it's her year.
Okay, I think
Oscars
it's her year too. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you think, Chris?
I would probably side with Anne Hathaway for Rachel Getting Married, because that movie's got a lot of buzz. She's
yeah.
young. She's really starting to catch some momentum now in terms of her career, and it feels like although it does seem like it's Kate Winslet's year because she's got these two big movies, I'd happen to go to Anne Hathaway. But I do want to say that I think this category this year is also not only representative of what you're talking about, Jamie, about recognizing those smaller performances, but also an example of what we were talking about earlier, which is I don't think they're watching these movies. Meryl Streep is in this category. Meryl Streep, first of all, Doubt is only playing in, what, two cities, and I'm not even sure if it's completely opened in those two cities or what's going
it's
on with that movie.
It's playing on 15 screens, I think.
It's playing on 15 screens, okay. Meryl Streep, from everything I've read about this movie, even the people that say it's a decent movie seem to harp on her performance as frankly not being that good. As being
that's what
good.
I've heard, yeah.
Yeah, and here it is. Doesn't this scream, oh, it's a Meryl Streep movie. It's a Meryl Streep movie from a big you know, play that everybody's heard of. It's John Patrick Shanley or whatever his name is. Let's just go ahead and nominate it, you
mm-hmm.
know.
I am looking forward to Doubt.
I'm looking forward to
that. And when you talk about it only being in a couple of cities, I mean, these people are mailed these films far in advance of their nominations. The people are vetting for their vote. So they have the opportunity to see it. I don't think they go to the theaters to see it, or they go
right.
to critic screenings, I'm sure. But
I'm still not sure that they even watch those screeners. Like, have you not read the same thing about this performance?
No,
yeah,
You're right.
You're absolutely right, and she gets nominated every year because she's one of the best, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think you're probably right. But you think it's Anne Hathaway's year, and I think Kate Winslet is just unbeatable. I mean, I think that she's deserving for her entire career as much as this year that she's had now. So that's where we stand on that.
Jerry.
Well, I think it's Kate Winslet too, but I'm basing everything on Kate Winslet from Little Children, and I've seen The Reader, and I don't know if I'd have to go look at who else is nominated. I'm not sure about her performance in The Reader, but I've seen Anne Hathaway, I've seen Angelina Jolie. I think Angelina Jolie's performance can be thrown out. I like the movie, I like her, but I just don't think I think there are other performances this year that I think are better.
But
that's
she's nominated for Revolutionary Road, right?
Yeah, I was talking about Angelina Jolie, though.
Winslet's also nominated for the Reader, but for supporting actress.
Yeah, for supporting. I don't know, but okay. I think Kate Winslet may very well win it for this, but I have to say, of the things I've seen, though, Kristin Scott Thomas, for me, I would have to go with.
Okay. What's our next category?
Best performance by an actor in a motion picture drama, and this is the biggie. This
sure
is the big one. DiCaprio for A Revolutionary Road, Frank Langella, Frost Nixon, Sean Penn, Milk, Brad Pitt, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and the greatest actor of our generation, Mickey Rourke for The Wrestler.
Yeah. Chris, take a crack.
We can go ahead and throw out Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt. Let's be perfectly honest. No offense, I love both those guys. But I just don't think that they're realistic contenders in this category this particular year.
Given their competition, in particular.
Given their competition, exactly. That's not based on their performances. I just mean based on, in particular, Sean Penn in Milk and Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler. It seems like it's between those two. But
I think
Frank Langella is very good in the Frost Nixon, and it's possible that he could, you know, build some steam. But it does definitely seem like it's between Penn and Mickey Rourke. In which case, I'd have to take Mickey Rourke.
I'm going with Rourke.
That movie will be rolling out at that time, really starting to fan out across the country, and I think, I'd have to go with Mickey Rourke.
I go with Mickey Rourke, too, as much for the story of his career resurrection as much as for the film and the performance itself, even though I'm sure he's just exceptional in the film. But the story is just too good. I mean, for him to come back in the fashion that he has,
mm-hmm.
with this kind of performance. Sean Penn is wonderful. I mean, I'm one that always thinks that Sean Penn is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But it surprises me, the reviews of this movie that say that everyone's so surprised that it's a performance of tremendous heart, and you don't expect that from Sean Penn. Because I always expect that from Sean Penn. That's what he acts with. He's not an intellectual actor. He's full on emotion. And Milk is indicative of that. But also a subpar movie like I Am Sam, I found has most relevance to his performance in Milk. In terms of just the openness and the smile and the welcoming of, you know, he has that in his performances. But I think it's going to be Rourke's year, no doubt.
I think so, too. Okay, do we want to do...
TV, no. Okay.
No, okay. I didn't really want to go there, but
we'll
right.
cover all the film.
All right. Let's do best performance by an actress in a motion picture, comedy, or musical. Rebecca Hall, Vicky Cristina Barcelona, Sally Hawkins, Happy Go Lucky, Frances McDormand, Burn After Reading, Meryl Streep, Mamma Mia, and Emma Thompson for Last Chance Harvey.
Yeah, Last Chance Harvey is another one, and Jerry, I know you've seen that this week.
I saw it this morning, yeah.
Yeah, another one that I think is a Globe exclusive,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah. Just like Burn After Reading. Burn After Reading is Globe. You're not going to see that Burn After Reading when it comes around Oscar time. You know, like Jerry said, decent movie, but not top shelf Coen Brothers stuff.
No, not at all. I think there's only one real person to pick on here, and I think we're all in agreement of who that is.
Rebecca Hall.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. It really feels like that's the one performance here, especially being that it's a Woody Allen movie. It is a very good performance. You know, the actresses in Woody Allen movies do very well at award shows, so.
So you guys think Rebecca Hall will win?
Oh, that I don't know. I think that Sally Hawkins may win, but I'm not head over heels about that movie or that performance.
So there's Rebecca Hall, Sally Hawkins,
Frances McDormand.
Okay.
Frances McDormand, Meryl Streep, and Emma Thompson.
Oh. Ah, wow.
But I think, Meryl Streep, too. I mean, you know.
I think Meryl Streep's going to get it. And I think that Rebecca Hall is by far the most deserving of it.
I agree.
That's my take.
That's an interesting. We're taking a lot of different choices here on some categories. This should be interesting.
Yeah, and this is just the mindset of the Globes. This isn't anything except when I say Meryl Streep deserves to win. It's such a highly popular movie. She looks like she has so much fun in it. Very well received by the world. and the world stage.
Yeah.
This being the Hollywood Foreign Press and the comedy category being such a singular category to that group. I think that it's going to be Meryl Streep. But Rebecca Hall, for me, gave one of the very best female performances of the year, and I'm so glad that she got recognized by someone.
Right. Okay. I wouldn't be surprised, Jamie, though, if it happened around Oscar time, too. If you look at this category, there does seem like there's a couple people missing from this category, doesn't there? Now, for instance, Viola Davis,
wouldn't
that be in supporting, though? Wouldn't that be...
That would be supporting drama.
Yeah, that would be supporting drama, and she is nominated for supporting.
All right, my mistake.
No, that's all right. No. I mean, it gets very confusing.
You're allowed one mistake.
I'm jumping ahead of myself here.
Yeah. Let's go to what I think is a very interesting category, and there's four out of the five people are very good in this category. It's the best actor in a comedy or musical. Javier Bardem for Vicky Cristina Barcelona, Colin Farrell and Brendan Gleeson for In Bruges, Dustin Hoffman for Last Chance Harvey, and James Franco for Pineapple Express.
Very interesting. It's got to be one of the guys from In Bruges here, doesn't it? Now, don't get me wrong.
I don't know. They might cancel each other out.
You think so?
I love both of them, but I'm going to go with James Franco.
Really?
Oh, Pineapple Express is it's really funny. You have two of these movies that I adore, In Bruges and Pineapple Express. But in Milk, too. Milk and Pineapple Express are the two films that he's most proud of. And he is just spectacular in Pineapple Express.
He better be most proud of those two films, because he doesn't actually...
It's great. He said about Fanboys, Annapolis, and what's the other one, Tristan and Isley. He said, you know, you work on these films for a couple months, you do all this preparation, and when they come out, you see them, you're just like, what did I waste my life doing?
Yeah.
So, he knows more than we do.
Actor. This is one of those nominations, I think, that Jamie probably was talking about. Maybe not this movie in particular, but this nomination fits in that category of, whoa, that was unexpected, you know, didn't see that coming at all. And if so, it does seem like this should be a supporting role, but I don't know. It's really strange. So you think he's going to win this, then?
James Franco?
Yes.
No, I don't think he's going to win. It's just my favorite, even more.
Okay.
I really, I really love that movie a lot.
So who do you
really
think
will
win?
It's really well done. It's by a director who never did those kind of films before, and did it so well, and the cast, I mean, Franco and Rogan, McBride is good. I mean, everyone is very good in the film, and just to see him get some notice for it is just...
So who do you think will win, Jerry?
Who do I think will win? I wouldn't be surprised if they give it to Dustin Hoffman.
Really?
I don't think the film is very... run-of-the-mill, but it's a feel-good film, so that might spark, you know, something. But I would say, and Javier is very good in Vicky Cristina Barcelona. I mean, he's just wonderful, but I don't know if he would get it again, but that could happen. I don't know.
This is a real I-don't-know category for me. I think it'll be James Franco.
Okay, all right.
Personally.
I'd have to go with Brendan Gleeson for In Bruges here.
Okay.
That's a great choice.
I know a lot of times when two people from the same movie are nominated, we say that they'll split the nomination, and maybe that'll happen. But I liked Colin Farrell and In Bruges, but I didn't feel like he was doing anything, you know, particularly Oscar or you know, award worthy.
Mm-hmm. But he's getting better though.
Oh yes. Although I've always thought Colin Farrell was a pretty good actor. I've never hated on him like
that. No. No, but I think with this, the back-to-back of this and Cassandra's Dream, though, it was just a great year for him. Even Pride, he's very good in Pride and Glory, too. So this was a really good year for him, as it was for Sam Rockwell, who's nowhere up here and should be.
Should be for a couple different movies this year, actually.
Yeah. Choke and Frost Nixon and Snow Angels, he just gave both
Snow
of
Angels
actors,
in particular. I was a little disappointed that Snow Angels had no love on this list
at
all, actually.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic movie. Okay, why don't we do the two supporting categories and best pitch and best director? How does that sound?
That sounds good.
Okay, best performance by an actress in a supporting role, Amy Adams for Doubt, Penelope Cruz for Vicky Cristina Barcelona, Viola Davis for Doubt, Marissa Tomei for The Wrestler, Kate Winslet for The Reader. Wow, okay. Where do we stand on this?
I think it could be Penelope Cruz.
I think she's incredible in the film, and I would definitely give it to her. But I haven't seen Doubt or The Wrestler, and I've heard Marissa Tomei is incredible in The Wrestler.
Right.
Yeah, it does seem like Marissa Tomei is one of those people that has been made fun of for years, but for some reason she's not going away. She keeps showing up.
Right.
And I feel like maybe this could go to her to sort of validate, you know, like not that anyone would be thinking that far into it, but frankly, you know, if it's a really good performance, she might be deserving of it. I wouldn't be surprised if she took it, but I also would not be surprised if Penelope Cruz won it, who is a very good actress. She is very good in this movie. It's the showy performance in the movie. It's the, you know, it's the very lively, colorful performance that you walk away, that you notice when you're watching the movie, but when you walk away, you're thinking about Rebecca Hall.
Yeah.
In more ways than one.
Do you think there's a possibility this could go to Davis because there's a lot of buzz around her performance and Doubt?
Yeah,
I have major doubts about Doubt, because frankly, like I said, I want to see the movie too, but I have not read a lot of good stuff about Doubt. I have not read a lot of reviews that were very kind to it.
The New Yorker savaged it. And one of the shortest reviews Anthony Lane has written, he just went after that, and he went after The Reader too.
Yeah,
I think that could play a role, but less so in a category like this. And I think Viola Davis has been a favorite among critics and among the moviegoers for a long time. She just hasn't found a movie where that movie demands so much attention. It could be the one. I just think Penelope Cruz is the most fiery, kind of passionate of these performances. I think that that's going to spark a win for her.
Okay. All right. Let us go to Best Supporting Actor, and this is another. I think there's only one appropriate answer for this, but I think all of the awards are good. But Tom Cruise and Robert Downey Jr. for Tropic Thunder, Ralph Fiennes for The Duchess, Philip Seymour Hoffman for Doubt, and Heath Ledger for The Dark Knight.
Yeah, it does
sort of feel like rhinoceros, giraffe, elephant, brontosaurus, mouse. Like, I mean, it's just like, which one of these things is not like the others, you know?
Yeah,
right.
It feels like no chance. Is it even conceivable that this could go to one of these other guys?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's going to be Heath Ledger, and for great reason, because that is the most inventive performance of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was listening to the soundtrack in my car this morning, and that's all I could think of was just his cackle and just the performance and just his mannerisms throughout the film. And I just don't see anyone coming along and taking this away from him for in the foreseeable future. I mean, and I think you would really do have to give the credit where it's deserved, and he deserves it without a doubt.
No chance. And by the way, Tom Cruise does not belong in this category.
I don't think so either.
Can we go ahead and put that out there? Like,
you don't think his performance is good in this? You don't think?
No, I don't. No.
I think it's serviceable. I don't think there's anything extraordinary or special.
Oh, nothing extraordinary.
No.
I like the performance, though. I don't know if it... I would say of the
nominees... I don't think it's a performance.
I think
Robert Downey Jr.,
though, deserves to be...
Yes, Robert Downey Jr. does, but Tom Cruise, and I like Tom Cruise, but Tom Cruise is in a fat suit with a bald head on, shouting expletives. Now,
No. But I think it was more of a PR thing for him. I think he's good in it. Do I think he deserves to be nominated? That I don't know. But I do think that Downey deserves to be there. But now I see what you guys are saying. Who would you put? All right, let's take Tom Cruise out. Let's take Ralph Fiennes out for The Duchess, because as much as I like Ralph Fiennes, I think he should have gotten nominated for The Reader, not for this, The Duchess.
Yeah.
Who do you think, who would you like to see there?
I would
or Ralph Fiennes
to
for
have...
In Bruges.
Yeah, well, Ralph Fiennes was good in that. Or how about one of those Sam Rockwell performances we were talking about?
Oh, I would put him in for Frost
instance,
Nixon.
Frost Nixon or for Snow Angels. He's very good in both those movies. I would personally lean towards Snow Angels, but he does capture that, like, angry liberal journalist vibe in Frost Nixon very well.
Right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I think there's a couple other performances throughout the year. Easily, if you sift through, you probably wouldn't even have to go back that far, and you could find several which are more deserving. You know, I mean, I think a lot of actors in Hollywood look at this, that nomination in particular. Like you said, they get it. They understand, oh, this is a PR move, but,
right.
Like, you know, come on. There's people that are way more deserving.
Right, right. Okay, let's do the director, because I think this is a fascinating category. Danny Boyle for Slumdog Millionaire, Stephen Daldry for The Reader, David Fincher for The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Ron Howard for Frost Nixon, and Sam Mendes for Revolutionary Road.
Again, no Gus Van Sant for Milk.
No Chris Nolan for The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
Well, there's also something else that's missing in this category. You know, Golden Globes, they do the best drama and the best comedy. Well, this best director is all the five best dramas with none of the five best comedies in it. It's just the same directors from the dramas, you know. So what does that tell you about that comedy category? It does seem a little too superfluous some years.
Yeah. You're right.
I would love to see Fincher win it.
Mm-hmm. Likewise.
To be recognized for something in his extraordinary career. I think he has a real shot. I think Danny Boyle, there's a lot of love for that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, when it comes to versatility,
he's very versatile,
Yeah. I would put it between the two of them, actually. Probably leaning towards Danny Boyle.
Okay.
See, I would put it between the two of them, probably leaning towards David Fincher, actually.
You want to thumb wrestle for it?
Well, yeah, you guys live closer. I'll let you thumb wrestle. All right, here's the thing. I think Stephen Daldry is a very interesting director. I don't think he has a chance in this category, but I think...
You were really not impressed by this movie, were you?
No, I was. But I like the movie, and I think it's a very troubling movie. So, Chris, and it's the second half where it's not the first half, but it's the second half, because the way it, you do have to ask yourself, they make Kate Winslet's character maybe too sympathetic. And there's a scene at the end, the way it's leading up, you're thinking something completely different. You know, you're thinking, you know, if it ended another way, there would have been laughing and boos, because they make her so sympathetic that you really think you're, like, wondering what kind of freak show you've just walked into.
Well, Nazis have feelings too.
Oh no, I'm not saying that. Look, I mean, we could do five shows on Nazi era films and movies about Nazis, and we would be fired. But they're thrown off. But it's a good film, Chris. I actually strongly recommend it, but it's the second half, which is, like, is very wild, at least to me, given my feelings and my knowledge about the Holocaust and everything about the war and about the films it's referencing and the way it's done. And then there's this end scene with Lena Olin that almost cancels out the whole movie, I think. It's a fascinating film, but I don't know if it's as good as everyone. I think Harvey must have done some big-time lobbying just to get it
this
far.
Oh, yeah.
And the other reason it's up here, I told this to Jamie last week after seeing it, it's the last produced film by Sidney Pollack and Anthony Minghella.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, the major reason this is up there.
So who do you think will get it?
Who do I think? Fincher.
Okay. Let's hope so. That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, next category. Do we have screenwriting here?
Let's do screenwriting. Everyone's upset with us for doing these nominations. Or Anthony Thurber's upset with us. Let's put it like that.
We're a movie show. We're not going to cover the second biggest movie award show of the year.
let's do screenplay.
Back on the switchboard now. It only took me an hour and a half to do it.
You want me to stay on?
Status quo. Everything's operating fine throughout the show on my switchboard. It was just my computer. Everything's great.
Okay, here we
go. Go ahead, Jerry.
It's all the same. We have John Patrick Shanley for Doubt, Eric Roth for Benjamin Button, Peter Morgan for Frost Nixon, David Hare for The Reader, Simon Beaufoy for Slumdog Millionaire.
I think it's going to be Frost Nixon.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Seems like between that and Slumdog Millionaire, I don't know. Depending on what happens in the Best Picture category, they might want to just give the screenplay award to Slumdog.
That's possible.
So I would probably lean towards Slumdog, but Frost Nixon would definitely be my number two.
Those are the major
categories.
What do you think, Jerry? Would you go with Slumdog or
I would go
Frost
with
Nixon?
I would. They're all. I think what I'm waiting to see is the audience reaction to Benjamin Button.
Right.
Because I see from other critics, like our friend Glenn Kenny and everything on Facebook, their status updates, and I think after a screening a couple of weeks ago of Benjamin Button, a lot of people said they liked it, but they weren't overwhelmed by it. Underwhelmed is a word they used with the film. So I'm very curious to see what my reaction to the film, but also the audience reaction over the holidays. But I think with screenplay, I think Frost Nixon's a good bet, and I think maybe Doubt.
Okay.
Maybe.
A Doubt could be a possibility. You know, Doubt and Frost Nixon are kind of cut from the same cloth.
Yeah.
They're character, dialogue heavy, based on Tony Award-winning plays. So that's a real matchup. I think in terms of the actors, it being an actor's piece, I think Frost Nixon has it.
I think the writing
quality of it. It wasn't just a transcription of the interviews, which, you know, I saw the interviews, and I only recognized a couple of moments from Frost Nixon from the interviews. I'm sure they're all based on them. It's just, obviously, it's cut down from the 12 hours that they spent on Nixon.
Right.
But I think that's got it. Don't we have a comedy screenplay category?
No. I think it's funny. Once you get out of those major categories, like the actor, actress, and best picture, then it's just regular, you know, it's just straight, just best screenplay.
Huh.
And they obviously don't have a best adapted screenplay.
Because comedies aren't written. That's right. I forgot that.
If
it was, I think that Neil McDonough would get it for In Bruges.
Yeah, I would give it best original screenplay for sure, and I think that's a strong
another playwright.
I think actually, do you want to do foreign film?
Yes.
I want to
do foreign films. Do they have a documentary category for the Golden Globes?
I will look. I'm just looking. I'm at Deadline Hollywood Daily, and I'm just going what she put up.
I don't believe they do.
I've only seen one of the films on here, but there's the other one that I haven't seen. I think there are two on here that are very strong contenders. The first one from Germany is the Bader-Meinhof Complex. From Sweden, we have Everlasting.
Who can resist that title?
Excuse me?
that'll get him out in droves.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you won't be able to get into that for weeks. Everlasting
That's like,
Moments from Sweden
that's
and
like
Denmark.
Naming your film Being John Malkovich. I mean, come on.
from Italy, Gomorra. I've Loved You So Long from France, which is not actually it's the other film, The Class, I think, is the official French picture for the Oscars. It's not this one.
Well, the original title of that film was Me Love You Long Time.
I knew you were going to say that. And Israel's Waltz with Bashir.
Yeah.
I think of these nominated, I think Gomorrah is the front runner because it won the European Film Awards last week. And it's a film I think all of us want to see, given the subject matter of the mafia in Naples, and it's a very anti-glamorization of that, of the mafia. So I think we're all curious about that. But I also think Waltz with Bashir has a lot of momentum with it, too.
I think Waltz with Bashir does, yeah.
Yeah.
That's my take. Waltz with Bashir.
Chris?
Yeah, I couldn't know less about any of these movies, sadly.
Well,
sorry, we don't get these down here in Polk County, so...
That's right.
We typically have to wait for them to come to DVD, and they often
order
do
through
not.
Through Netflix, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. They often do not.
Right.
I tell you, Netflix has been my best friend when it comes to foreign films.
Yeah, no, they're great.
You can't get them anywhere else around here.
Mm-hmm. No, that Netflix is great for that and the independent films, and the documentaries, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, even though there's not a documentary category, maybe we should close this out with what the which documentary we saw this year that really left an impact that we think should be nominated with the Oscars.
Well, there's one for me, but I don't think it's going to be recognized.
And which one is that?
It's Dear Zachary.
You don't
no
think
surprise
that,
there.
Well, no, and I'm looking forward to seeing that when I get some time. I can't wait to see that. You know, I would say, for me, of what I've seen, Gonzo or Man on a Wire or Or I like Religious a lot. That was good. American Teen, I think American Teen has a shot.
Religious is not in the running.
I know, but
I didn't think American Teen was eligible either. Was it?
No, it's probably not. I'm sure it's probably not on there. But those were, I mean, it was a good year for documentaries. Plus, there's a stuff, Body of War, which I'm about to watch this week, I think. And last year Taxi and the Dark Side won.
Body of War is very good, but yeah. And I watched American Teen again. And I was real high on that movie the first half of the year, and I still am. I was incredibly moved by it once again watching it. But Dear Zachary, it's really one of the most visceral, emotional movies I've ever seen.
And you did a great job interviewing that for that. So we did, you know, I don't think that they could ask for better press than this show.
It's a very sensitive movie in that you really have to watch the whole thing because it takes a turn in the last act that is devastating.
Right.
But and it's easy to watch the whole thing because that movie it just jumps into it with a start. It's almost like the JFK of documentaries.
Wow.
It's got such a cinematic feel to it. So I would choose that. I'm upset about Religious not being nominated or up for nominations because it's the most successful of the year. That says something when you're a documentary. You're obviously striking a nerve.
Right.
But, you know, and I don't know if Dear Zachary will get it, a nomination. I hope it does, though.
No, I hope so, too. It'll be.
So what do you guys think of this Oscar? This Oscar news that came out this year or this week about Hugh Jackman being the host?
I think he's a perfectly fine choice. I mean, I've made it known before that I think they should get rid of the host altogether because outside of the first 5 minutes of the show, I don't think it adds anything.
Right.
But as far as relating him to other hosts, yeah, he's not a stand-up comedian like Steve Martin or Chris Rock or Ellen DeGeneres, but I would also, sight unseen, hire him to do it before I would like to see Whoopi Goldberg do it again. He's at least a very talented performer. He's an entertainer. He's a song and dance man. He's hosted the Tonys and was apparently very good, although I did not see it. And also, we know he's probably not going to get nominated for an Oscar. So
yeah. Now that movie was left out altogether. And I enjoyed that movie. The more I think about it, the more I like that movie. It doesn't hit, and for at least for me, it didn't hit me immediately. But the more I think about Australia, the more I like it. But
that's the same life that Moulin Rouge had, if you remember. It took a couple months before people started remembering, hey, that was a pretty good movie.
Yeah,
you know?
You're right. You're absolutely right.
I don't know if there's enough time on this one.
No, I don't. I honestly don't think there is. I think Hugh Jackman is an excellent choice because it's not something I would have. It's not the first of all the people we were talking about a couple of weeks ago. That name wasn't on anybody's radar.
No, but it's surprising. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
Right? And plus, and he's got a big movie coming out a couple months afterwards, so, you know.
Yeah, it's a big promo for the new Wolverine.
Yeah, it's a huge promo for that.
Yeah, because this year is the first year when they're going to be allowed to have movie trailers during the Oscars.
Yeah.
But not related to any of the nominated.
Right.
Not related, which, you know, obviously, like, that's not what we want to see around that time anyway. We want to see, you know,
I still remember. I still remember Billy Crystal getting out on stage on a horse promoting City Slickers 2 or something the year he was hosting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the I think that Hugh Jackman's fine. I think it's being produced by first-timers, musical theater people. And then adding Hugh Jackman as the MC, I don't think we'll get another Rob Lowe with Snow White, but I think that there'll be a musical theater vibe to it.
Right.
I think it'll be a show that they put on. Which, if it's a good show, I don't have a problem with that.
Not at all.
And, of course, Spielberg is getting the Cecil B. DeMille Lifetime Achievement Award. He was supposed to get it last year, but, you know, Billy Bush and Nancy O'Dell handing it over wasn't occasion enough. So, you know, and how do you pay tribute to Spielberg's career? I mean, it's a landmine of classic movies. It's almost dumbfounding that he hasn't gotten it already.
I know. Yeah.
Every award known to man, stones, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize for E.T. You know.
Yeah.
I don't know. So, Chris, are you? What are you most looking forward to seeing now that these films are going to come our way in the next few weeks?
I am most looking forward to Benjamin Button and The Wrestler. I would have to say those two. Although. Not on the same level of those two movies. I gotta say, I'm kind of interested in seeing Marley and Me. I think that's gonna be a fun Christmas family, you know, Christmas Day family movie.
Mm-hmm.
And my family typically goes to the movies on Christmas Day, so I think it looks like a sweet movie. Good book. Interested.
Hmm. And you think Jennifer Aniston is hot? I mean, let's get to the real point of why.
I
want
do
to see this
think
film.
That Brad Pitt is a maniac because, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you just want to see Benjamin Button because you wish you were Brad Pitt.
Who doesn't?
Well, yes. I'm also in love with Cate Blanchett, so let's forget that.
Oh, she's gorgeous, isn't she? Oh, man. All right. It's getting steamy in here, so before it gets out of control. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll be back Wednesday night. We're going to have a Benjamin Button show with, among other guests, Claudio Miranda, the Golden Globe-nominated cinematographer of Benjamin Button, and also some other talents from that film as well. Next week, we'll be dedicating an hour to The Spirit with actor Louis Lombardi and the visual effects supervisor from that film, too, so we'll have some good conversation on that. We'll also air our Sal Stable interview concerning his new film, Where God Left His Shoes, starring John Leguizamo. This is a great little movie, a great movie to see during the holiday season. It's very moving, and the best Leguizamo's ever been, I think. He's perfect.
You think wonderful. Better than Nothing Like the Holidays?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I was being facetious.
Nothing But the Holidays is actually getting very good notices. They say it's an above-average holiday family movie. But,
really,
I
didn't see that. I heard it was like a Tyler Perry kind of movie.
Yeah, that's exactly what they said on In the Movies, actually, compared to the Tyler Perry movie.
Yeah, I've read two great reviews of it, and EW gave it like a B or B plus.
Oh, I think you'd say Armand White liked it a lot.
No, if Armand liked it, I wouldn't be. I wouldn't like it. So. You'd need to read Armand's column where he traces the Obama victory to Soul Man in the 80s.
Okay, can we just okay, I'm really going to go throw up now, and I haven't even eaten dinner yet.
Right. All right, guys, thank you. Thank you, Chris and Jerry.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, everyone out there in the chat land, and we'll see you on Wednesday night.
Okay, have a great night, everyone.